Ukrainian forces free another city that's been under Russian control for months.
Yesterday, Ukrainian officials confirmed that Ukrainian forces liberated the village of Kisilivka. This is the one which is very close to the city of Kherson itself.
Plus, what it takes to get vital humanitarian assistance into recently liberated cities.
The roads are damaged. Bridges are also not easy to cross. Sometimes we have to bypass them. So security and accessibility is a concrete challenge.
And later in the program, a look ahead at next week's United Nations General Assembly. Today is Thursday, September 15th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is hosting European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen for talks Thursday in Kyiv. The von der Leyen said would include, quote, getting our economies and people closer while Ukraine progresses toward accession, end quote. Ukraine applied to join the European Union in late February, days after Russia launched its invasion. The EU granted Ukraine candidacy status in June. Anna Chernikova joins us from Kyiv as fighting continues across Ukraine's south.
We finally get at least some details about this counteroffensive in the Kherson region. Yesterday, Ukrainian officials confirmed that Ukrainian forces liberated the village of Kisilivka. This is the one which is very close to the city of Kherson itself. So for the moment, the only city which is between Ukrainian forces and the city of Kherson is Chernobyevka. We've heard a lot about Chernobyevka previously as well. This is a city where where Russian forces had a lot of their equipment and certain bases, and Ukrainian forces have already shelled this place for a lot of times. So for the moment, this is basically the only spot which is in between, and it is very, very close to the city of Kherson. So we will continue to have our eye on the advances.
Thank you for that update, Anna. And just to let everyone know, before we actually clicked record to speak today, you let me know that there had been at least three air raid sirens where you are there in Kyiv. And I guess that kind of brings me to my next topic, and that's the city of Kryvyi Rih, where you let me know that that city had received shelling overnight.
Yes, actually, air raid siren is still on over the whole territory of Ukraine, and we're getting reports that Kryvyi Rih is attacked again. It's the third time in this last 24 hours. What happened yesterday is that after President Zelensky visited the city of Izum, Russian forces attacked the city of Kryvyi Rih, which is originally his hometown. And in a couple of hours after the attack, we got confirmation that Russian forces targeted the hydrotechnical structure in Kryvyi Rih, which is known as a dam, and it's very important in the region. It keeps a huge amount of water. For this attack, Russian forces used Kinjal and Iskander missiles, which means that this attack was very specifically targeted to this particular area and this particular dam, because these are two very precise and very expensive missiles. So as a result, we know about the flooding of at least 112 houses and yards. This is a private sector mostly, but also the residential buildings in the city. So in some settlements, there were water interruptions because of the attack. Over the night, the rescue team was working very hard to make sure that water is not, the level of water is not going up. For the moment, we know that the maximum point water level reached was 190 centimeters. Now it is lower. Now it's much lower. It's 65.
Anna, thank you very much for that reporting. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
Thank you, Steve.
Russian President Vladimir Putin on Thursday said that he understood that Chinese President Xi Jinping had questions and concerns about the situation in Ukraine, but praised China's leader for what he said was a balanced position on the conflict. These are Putin's first remarks about Chinese concern over the conflict, and they come as both attend the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Speaking of which, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan heads to Uzbekistan on Thursday to attend the SCO. Erdogan is attending at the invitation of Russian President Vladimir Putin. The meeting comes as Erdogan's relations with Putin are under growing scrutiny by its Western allies as they seek to tighten sanctions on Russia. Dorian Jones takes it from here.
The loyalties of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan are likely to face growing scrutiny from his traditional Western allies, with his attendance Friday at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in Uzbekistan. The Russian and Chinese-led Eurasian Security Group is dubbed by some critics an anti-Western alliance. Erdogan's attendance and scheduled meeting with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, the third in as many months, will fuel questions over Turkey's Western loyalties, says Asla Aydintashbaş, a visiting scholar with the Brookings Institution think tank.
Erdogan likes to do this balancing act, and it serves a purpose. He wants to signal to the West that he has other options. Turkey has grown rather close to Russia, particularly economically rather dependent on Russia. Not only has Ankara not joined the Western sanctions, but it has also continued to trade with Russia and has received Russian finances.
Some analysts say trade with Russia is increasingly crucial to Turkey's crisis-ridden economy, which could prove vital to Erdogan, who faces re-election next year. Friday's talks between Putin and Erdogan are expected to focus on trade. Maria Shangina of the International Institution for Strategic Studies says with Western countries seeking to tighten sanctions on Moscow, Erdogan is also becoming increasingly important to Putin.
Russia is running out of good friends here. They have China, India that they can pivot to, but the room for maneuver where Beijing and New Delhi would have appetite to face secondary sanctions is just not there. So it's important for Moscow to have another friend in need, and Ankara, unlike Beijing, Ankara is actually more risk prone.
Erdogan this month called for the easing of some sanctions on Russia, but Ankara insists it's not violating US international sanctions and is taking a balanced approach toward Russia and Ukraine, with Turkish armament companies continuing to supply Kyiv. Erdogan's stance toward Russia is expected to top the agenda of talks if the Turkish president meets with US President Joe Biden on the sidelines of next week's United Nations General Assembly in New York. But analyst Aydintashbaş says Biden faces a dilemma with Ankara.
Washington is doing its own balancing act when it comes to Erdogan. They don't like the fact that he's not joined Western sanctions on Russia. On the other hand, they don't want to push Turkey further towards Russia, so they have refrained from speaking out.
With both European Union and Washington expected to step up efforts to tighten sanctions on Russia, analysts warn Turkey's balancing act with Russia could prove increasingly difficult to sustain. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
And for more on what's happening in Ukraine throughout the day, be sure to visit voanews.com/flashpoint. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. As the war in Ukraine approaches the seven-month mark next week, humanitarian aid continues to flow into areas of the country that have recently been liberated from Russian occupation. Yesterday, I spoke with Ukraine Program Manager for the International Committee of the Red Cross and began our conversation by asking Daniel Bunskog what the ICRC is seeing on the ground.
Many of these territories that have recently been retaken by the Ukrainians have been very difficult, even impossible to access for the ICRC, whereas our response has continued in all places where we have safe and secure access. Starting from this week already, so Monday, we have been traveling out and delivering assistance, emergency assistance to some of the populations in these recently retaken areas. For example, in Balaklia and Izium today, in Chkolovsky. We're focusing right now on the basic needs. We know that people have not necessarily been able to get what they need in terms of food, in terms of hygienic items. So we are focusing now to deliver these things quickly to large numbers of people. So far, it's almost 6,000 people that have benefited from that assistance just in the last 3 days in that area. And what we see there is of course, first of all, important needs for basic humanitarian assistance. We also see that certain people, especially the older generations, so older persons in need of accessing health services and social services, even issues such as accessing, you know, public government pensions is going to be a challenging feat because many of these localities have hard times accessing the internet. So connectivity has also been disrupted. So we are focusing now on the base to start, and we're going to try to reach out to as many of these communities as possible, in addition to the ongoing response in other parts of Ukraine. And also over time, if we can assist in ways that cover some of those more pervasive needs. We have programs together with the Ukrainian Red Cross Society, for example, on mobile health clinics to have primary healthcare services reach out to areas and to populations that cannot necessarily move in safe conditions and who are in need. And we know also from our very recent experience that accessing these new localities, if I can call them like that, is not an easy feat neither, because the roads are damaged. Bridges are also not easy to cross. Sometimes we have to bypass them. So security and accessibility is a concrete challenge that not only the humanitarians will face, but also the population once they would start moving around and trying to access services and such.
On this notion of the security and getting to these areas that have been recently freed by Ukrainian forces, you mentioned you're focusing on getting the essential items there, the bare necessities. But there have been, you know, discussions and stories of elderly individuals, people who were not able to flee when the fighting first erupted because of being either infirm or just not physically able to do that, the shortages of medication. So I guess, could you expand a little bit upon, you know, what the ICRC is doing to help get that kind of basic care to these areas, the challenges that you're finding, and then also, you know, how do you, you know, prioritize what you can do, because going into an area, you may not know what's needed. So how is that communicated back to, you know, a central location so that the proper aid can get to where it's most needed?
It's a very good question. I'll start from the end of your question. So the ICRC in Ukraine, first of all, we've been working in this country for more than 8 years. And there is our experience from an armed conflict that is using a specific type of weapons. There's a lot of explosive weapons, as you know, and a lot of consequences that are inherent to the type of warfare that is being conducted. So accessibility and time is not always what humanitarians have when you need to act fast. So we have to base ourselves on experience and based on the information that we also receive from the Ukrainian local, central, regional authorities on what the most basic needs are. And we are lucky enough to have supplies always in stock, pipelines that are functioning that we can deliver fast. And this is in the first immediate phase of our response. Once we start being able to access areas more regularly and more safely, now also autumn is coming, the days are getting shorter. We need to make sure that our teams can do this safely. But once we do, then we can also understand, based on our expertise and assessments locally, what can be done more to cover some of these pervasive needs that most particularly the vulnerable population are facing. So I mentioned before, for example, mobile health units and clinics, which are auxiliary efforts to reach populations that are not able to move for different reasons. They don't have transportation means. They're older persons. They don't have family anymore to help them get to the bigger cities. These are mobile health units that go out to areas to provide basic primary health care to people, and also to flag needs and referrals of very specific patients. So that is something that we are already running together with Ukrainian Red Cross Society and the regional health authorities in some regions of Ukraine, for example, north of Kyiv, where such programs were already launched and are working quite successfully. And we're looking to expand that together with them in many, many other places in Ukraine. And I think here we have opportunities to reflect and see if that can be done in the coming weeks and months.
Can you explain a little bit in greater detail what these mobile health facilities are able to do, and those that need additional care, what opportunities are being presented to them so that they are better cared for?
So the mobile health units are basically mobile ambulances that come into to places that are difficult to access with the essentials, so essential drugs and with health personnel from the Ukrainian health authorities to provide immediate health care, especially to chronically ill, and bring in necessary medicine. But when it comes to more severe and complex cases, these mobile health units also help identify such cases to find alternative solutions for them. For example, if such a mobile health unit would go in to Balaklia, and we see that, and they see that there are specific needs for a number of persons to reach a hospital that they haven't been able to reach for a while, that would trigger additional action to that, which of course falls under the purview of the regional health authorities that we of course support. This is all in support mode to the existing health system. This is not an add-on, but rather a support. But it's very case by case and in support of local health authorities who will help bring these people back in. And if humanitarians such as the ICRC are able and needed to support, there are many new and creative ways that we can also think of.
Daniel Bunskog is the ICRC's Ukraine Programs Manager, and I spoke to him in Kyiv, Ukraine, and we'll be having more of our conversation on Friday's program. This year's gathering of leaders at the United Nations General Assembly is taking place in the shadow of Queen Elizabeth II's funeral, and as the war in Ukraine heads into a possibly decisive period. VOA United Nations correspondent Margaret Bashir provides this look ahead.
Queen Elizabeth's funeral on September 19th has presented logistical challenges for leaders attending the 77th session of the United Nations General Assembly. Some speeches and meetings may have to be shuffled as they dash from London to New York. This year's meeting takes place at a time of great peril, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says.
Our world is blighted by war, battered by climate chaos, scared by hate, and shamed by poverty, hunger, and inequality.
Russia's war in Ukraine, which may be at a militarily decisive moment, is certain to dominate the annual meetings. The UN Security Council will meet Thursday at the foreign ministers' level to discuss developments. The situation of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant is of particular concern. Rafael Mariano Grossi is the International Atomic Energy Agency Director General.
We are playing with fire. We cannot continue in a situation when we are one step away from a nuclear accident. The safety of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant is hanging by a thread.
Western officials, meanwhile, want to firm up support from some countries that may be wavering as the war grinds on. Richard Gowan is the UN director for the International Crisis Group.
Many African and Asian countries have security relationships with Russia or economic relationships with Russia. And while they were willing to criticize the invasion back in March, they don't want to keep on picking fights with Moscow at the UN.
But with Russian President Vladimir Putin not attending the annual gathering, he rarely does, and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's participation uncertain, no breakthrough is expected. Again, Antonio Guterres.
But I have no illusions that at the present moment the chances of a peace deal are minimal.
Russia and Ukraine are important food producers, and their war has worsened a global food crisis. Supply chain disruptions and rising food prices are exacerbating the situation in the Horn of Africa, which is suffering its worst drought in 40 years. As many as 20 million people are at risk of severe hunger, and famine is looming for nearly 8 million people in Somalia. Abdurrahman Abdishakur is Somalia's special envoy for drought response.
The famine is real and it's happening.
President Joe Biden is expected to lead a high-level meeting on global food security, one of several sessions to tackle the issue. The Secretary General just returned from Pakistan, where deadly floods have submerged one-third of the country. He would like to see climate action high on leaders' agendas. Secretary General Guterres.
What is happening in Pakistan demonstrates the sheer inadequacy of the global response to the climate crisis and the betrayal and injustice at the heart of it.
This is the first time that leaders will participate fully in person at the General Assembly since 2020, the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, which has moved from the spotlight as leaders grapple with more pressing issues. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
And finally, Ukrainian athlete Lyudmila Jugalova spent several months in Kharkiv after Russia invaded her country. Eventually, the Olympic champion's son convinced her to leave the city and move to the western U.S. state of California, but he stayed behind. Anna Rice narrates this story from VOA's Russia service to round us out.
Retired Ukrainian athlete Lyudmila Jugalova is a two-time Olympic champion who won gold medals in track and field for the former Soviet Union in 1988 and a team of former Soviet republics in 1992. Born in the city of Katovsk in the Odessa region in 1962, she later moved to Kharkiv. In 1983, she met her future husband, also an athlete, who was originally from Ufa, Russia. Even after the end of their professional careers, the couple stayed in Kharkiv. It became home to them and their son.
He's Russian, I'm Ukrainian. He died 4 years ago. Maybe it's a good thing he never saw what would happen. Our son is half Russian, half Ukrainian. How can he live with what's going on?
Russia's invasion of Ukraine earlier this year brought near daily shelling to Kharkiv, but Jugalova initially was determined to stay put. As time went by, however, her son urged her to flee Ukraine, which she did in early July, leaving her son, who stayed in Kharkiv, to help deliver food to Ukrainian soldiers. California is her current place of residence, but not her home.
California. Physically, I'm here, but my heart is in Kharkiv. My son is there, he sleeps in the hallway to stay safe if the building is shelled.
Jugalova says almost 6 months after the start of the invasion, she is still trying to make sense of the war. She says the damage that has been done is immeasurable, not just destroyed buildings, but also destroyed families.
Half of the city is just destroyed. Zosim is doing volunteer work, and he has to go to the city. He says it's a dead zone there. The war has destroyed everything. I worked as a coach, and now I don't have anyone to pass my experience to. No children. All of my friends oppose the war, in Moscow, in St. Petersburg, in Chisinau. Not one person says Ukrainians deserve to die, not one person.
Jugalova, though physically safe in California, hopes to return to Ukraine as soon as she can, to walk the streets of her native town, to train children, and to feel free in her own country. For VOA Russian in Los Angeles, California, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that'll do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage, not only on Ukraine, but on news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms. Just be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of our entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.